Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, strategic sourcing in the Navy and the current state of the financial management workforce in DOD. Later in the program, we'll talk to Tracy Green from Grant Thornton. They and the American Society of Military Comptrollers have just finished their latest annual survey of the financial management community. First, though, a look at the Navy Department's approach to strategic sourcing. Department officials have just awarded blanket purchase agreements to 17 vendors who will provide conference planning services for the Navy and Marine Corps. We'll also talk about multiple award contracts for mobile services and for service contracting. Our guest for this is Jamie Hawk. He's the Navy Strategic Sourcing Program Manager based at the Naval Supply Systems Command Headquarters in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. With regard to conference planning, he says the contracts the Navy Department just let are in part a response to OMB and DOD edicts to reduce spending on government conferences, but they're also about getting better data.
As program manager for the Department of Navy Strategic Sourcing Program, we look at spend across the Navy, and we are happy to engage with other Defense Department agencies to look at spend, looking at, and not necessarily the direct contract spend, but also some of the other spends, the inefficiencies with the redundancy in contracting, because that's really important. We have a workforce out there that is basically churning the same vendor market. So obviously, if we can leverage existing vehicles or establish vehicles that we can all use together, we're freeing up our contracting workforce as well. So there's a value in soft savings, we'll say, as well as hard savings that can be achieved. But yes, we, from the strategic sourcing program, are always looking at the guidance OMB sets and DOD sets, and then, of course, Navy sets for achieving efficiencies. This particular project began back around 2011, and we had a little bit of a guidance, a policy memo came out, and talking about eliminating excess conference spending and promoting efficiencies in the government. So that was the, sort of the impetus that got our project started. We initially started just looking at the Navy spend, but then we did expand to include the other services.
And so as you examined the way that, you know, the Navy and the Defense Department as a whole actually conducted their conferences, what was it about that that made conferencing in particular look like a good target for strategic sourcing?
Well, we do have some organic government facilities, for instance, for conferences. And we also contract for a lot of facilities. And unfortunately, we didn't have visibility. So there was a couple things going on. There was an opportunity to create some visibility of existing government infrastructure and the resources we had, as well as then collecting the information about the contracts we were using to either source hotels and those types of facilities, as well as then the copying, printing, the publicizing of the events. Because we do often use those kinds of contractors, and there's costs obviously associated with using the vendors, especially if we have resources already available. So it was sort of a joint, two-sided effort there.
So am I understanding right that at least one of the objectives here was, well, first of all, you identified that there were underutilized government-owned facilities, and one of the objectives is to make more use of them. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the BPA itself. You just awarded it, as I understand. Talk a little bit about how that contract structure is actually going to work.
Well, the BPAs are structured off of the federal supply schedules, and the vendors, the significant portion here is that it is a 100% small business set-aside, so we're very excited about that. And so we support the socioeconomic programs as well. So the vehicles are going to be competitive. We've awarded 17, which is a healthy small community of vendors. So we will get competition at the task order level. The vehicles have been hosted on the GSA's eBuy site, so they are available to all DOD. They can be readily accessed through the reverse auction tool or through eBuy going to the GSA website. So that will facilitate the ease of use and the visibility of the vehicles. Now, what was important about the vehicles is that there is a reporting requirement in the BPAs, which will allow us to collect the attendance information, where the conference is being held, the number of people being participating, costs associated with the rental copying fees, as I mentioned, and any of the promotional costs that are associated with the conference will be reported by the vendor back to the Navy or to the respective agency. That could, and that information then is fed up to OSD as part of an ongoing OSD oversight of conferences.
That data collection, is the objective there more or less just to try and keep the vendors honest during the current period of performance, or do you anticipate plowing that data into, you know, the way that you structure future contracts or future conference planning?
Absolutely. You know, that data, it builds the next spiral of solutions, and it also helps us then evaluate costs so that we can make good decisions when it comes to future conference attendance and arrangements. Obviously, we've learned in the past there's seasonal cost variations. If you know there's off peak periods, for instance, that might be appropriate for having conferences and might be a better value to the government. And the more data we collect like that from the vendors, and the vendors really facilitating this, will allow us to make better decisions about conferences in the future.
The reverse auction aspect of this in particular, can you explain exactly how that mechanism works for people that aren't familiar with it and why you chose to go that route?
It's a great feature that GSA launched last summer, I guess around July of 2013, a functionality that's embedded in the GSA eBuy tool that will allow any contracting specialist who posts the requirement in the tool to request that instead of just getting a quote, you know, say, let us use an example, next week, we would have a quote come in. But the vendor, in this case, would be able to see that, oh, this is a reverse auction. I will have to check back during the 3 days or 5 days the RFQ is out there to see if I'm still positioned to win the award. And if it looks like the vendor can see if they're leading or lagging, they can tell if they're going to win, if they're in a position, or if they might have to adjust their price. And that's just a feature that will enhance, I think, the transparency. The vendors, you know, the vendors jockey for the business a little bit, and it takes the contracting specialist out of the role of having to do some sort of a negotiation if there's any concern about pricing.
And so it sounds like you're trying to make the conference planning purchasing process from the government side more or less turnkey. But as a government buyer of these services, how much control do I actually have? How much can I actually specify? I mean, can I say I want my conference to be at the Ronald Reagan Center and I want Chicken Kiev for lunch?
To the extent that a respective agency does not stipulate or provide policy, I would, and I hope that agencies take, we all as taxpayers hope agencies take the appropriate exercise of responsibility, that we manage requirements. We have to begin every acquisition with looking for the government's minimum requirement and trying to satisfy that. But the contract specialist, when it comes to execution, would have some discretion if there's a need to be in the Reagan Center or in that geographic area, that they would be able to designate the geographic area that would be desired and then engage the vendor to try to negotiate the best rate possible for that facility. But we always go back to the requirement and trying to define the requirement. As conscientious government employees, we must define the government's minimum need as our starting place. We can never dismiss the importance, the role of the requirements owners in the strategic sourcing process. I've drawn a pyramid diagram for a number of folks I've briefed about strategic sourcing. On one side, you have requirements. On the other side, you have the acquisition folks who have to execute the contract vehicle. The two finally reach a point at the top, and hopefully you've reached that right balance, the minimum government need balanced with the best contract solution, and we realize the best value for the government. And so we just can't dismiss the role, the important role of the requirements owners and defining that requirement. And this is across the board for any commodity or any service that we buy.
As far as the role of those requirements owners, I think if I'm understanding you right, you're talking about pre-award, before the BPAs were awarded. awarded.
That's right. And you can evaluate, you know, we can step back if time permits and we've done some degree of planning. And if we find that we may have overstated a requirement, we can step back and reevaluate and reassess and renegotiate what our minimum need might be. We can drop the gold plating if we were. And that's, again, across any commodity area, conferences or any other supplier service.
Sure. Okay, so this was originally designed to be a vehicle for the Department of the Navy, I think, but it's also open to all of DOD. How much have you socialized this idea outside of the Navy, and are you expecting to have an audience that's bigger than the Dawn?
Yeah, we are expecting an audience bigger than Dawn, and we've shared this with our friends over at the Pentagon, the DPAP community, the Defense Procurement Acquisition Group, and some of the strategic sourcing folks at Air Force as well as Army, and we're really excited that this is the first project we've awarded from scratch. We started with, before the solicitation had gone out in the street, and then engaged with the other services and finally issued it. We have a couple other projects coming out that will also include the other DOD components, but it's really exciting to share with them. We are still trying to get the word down to the grassroots, though, the folks who are out in the field who may have a requirement sometime during the fiscal year 15, then it might be starting to think about conferences. We do want to make sure the word gets down, and I know from the Navy side there's already discussion about policy to try to standardize and push down to the lowest echelons the awareness of these vehicles, and we're hoping the other services follow suit. We'll share with them recommendations along that way.
And beyond just awareness, within the Dawn anyway, is there a requirement to use these BPAs if you're going to go out and plan a conference, or do you expect to see that kind of guidance?
I am expecting to see that kind of guidance being issued. It's been discussed at the Dawn AA group there at the Pentagon, and they're the folks who then aggregate the reports that go up to higher DOD levels. So I do think that they're interested. They're excited about these vehicles because this is going to actually, again, for efficiency, take work off of them. Instead of doing data calls across the Navy, if we can get the user population to use these BPAs, it's going to aggregate the details of these conferences for them, and they won't have to do some of the data calls. And we probably in a year or two will be looking back at this golden age of data and visibility and transparency that we never had before.
That's Jamie Hawk, the program manager for the Department of the Navy's Strategic Sourcing Program. We'll come back and talk more about strategic sourcing, including the Navy's approach to mobility and to service contracting. After a quick break, this is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest for this part of the program is Jamie Hawk. He is the program manager for the Department of the Navy's Strategic Sourcing Program. As we discussed before the break, the Navy has just awarded 17 blanket purchase agreements for conference planning services across the Navy and Marine Corps, and eventually across all of DOD. Those BPAs may soon become the only approved way to arrange conferences for those two services. Beyond just conference planning, you're involved in multiple other areas of strategic sourcing within the Department of the Navy, including furniture and including mobility. Let's touch on mobility because there's some news there recently. I understand there was a memo signed out a couple weeks ago by the Dawn Chief Information Officer regarding wireless services. You want to tell us a little bit about that and how you're involved?
Yeah, we were very excited when the Dawn CIO, Chief Information Officer, issued a policy that is directing Echelon 2's commands, the major commands, to aggregate requirements to their level so that, for instance, in Echelon 2, like NAVSUP or NAVC, NAVFAC, at similar levels, they've been directed, and some of these commands have already aggregated requirements significantly, but then others, we still have some commands doing purchase card buying and purchase order buying. And there's a great opportunity, we learned, by aggregating requirements to initial on two level. And in one example, you know, we saw a command having more than 1,000 users on each order, and that they were able to reduce their the number of orders across their whole command, many thousands of customers, down to 8 orders. Now, at the task order level, they achieve better pricing than just the contract pricing, because the vendors will give you additional discounts if you have, like, it's similar to the family plan, where you have so many people on and then you add additional members at a fixed cost, like $15 per person or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nominal in comparison to just standing up one account. So there's a great efficiency there. And we were talking to the CIO some months back. The policy came out here on the 1st of August. There's been a lot of questions about how it's going to be implemented, but we're anxious, from the Strategic Sourcing Office, we're anxious to help commands engage with the wireless providers, with their contracting offices, so that they can more effectively place orders. And compounding with that, we're working on a tool, a database, which basically maintains the inventory of all the wireless accounts across Department of Navy. And with that tool, we can slice and dice and look at major commands and then their echelon threes and fours to see where there's possibilities, opportunities to consolidate. So I think we're estimating a $4 to $14 million potential savings if we could achieve maximum aggregation of requirements under this new policy.
And so that's where you are right now, just in the requirements aggregation process. Not that that's a small matter. It's a very big deal to do that across the entire Navy and all echelon twos. But what's the end game after you finish that?
Well, then the end game would be in successive recompetitions at the task order level, because now when you present to the wireless community, the AT&T, Verizon, et cetera, if you present these aggregated requirements to them, it would be very exciting to see how that might change pricing in future arrangements. Again, we have to think long term. We take these incremental steps, and I always draw a spiral. We build on the data, the knowledge, the pricing, and as we renegotiate, and of course the technology changes too, but we revisit that with every successive task order then. And certainly vendors will appreciate us presenting to them better managed requirements. And again, going back to the importance of requirements owners, better managed requirements allows the vendors to give you the optimal business arrangement.
And these sort of aggregated task orders, are they only for wireless services or devices and other things too?
Actually, the other devices, BlackBerries, et cetera.
Yeah. Gotcha. So service and the actual mobile device.
Everything. Yes.
Okay. And before we wrap up, let's talk a little bit about strategic sourcing as it relates to service contracting in the Department of the Navy. I know there's quite a bit of activity going on in that arena too. Tell us a bit about what you're working on.
We're working on a couple things, and I'll just mention we do have a couple projects that will be awarded, education and training. We have a couple, the solicitations already closed. We're going to be awarding BPAs for education and training services that will be available for all DOD. We also have the Spiral 2 of the Global Business Solutions contract being awarded out of our Fleet Logistics Center in the NFSUP Fleet Logistics Center in San Diego. That vehicle is aimed at 100% small business set aside and aimed at service contract act type work. It's a wonderful vehicle, again, promoting small business, promoting competition at the task order level, and again, working with customers to aggregate requirements so that we can present to the vendors very succinct packages. And I think that the Spiral 1 vehicle was really successful, and proving, again, small business being, you know, such an important part of the whole industrial base. But we're looking forward to the Spiral 2 probably by December.
Can you say a little bit more about the specific types of services involved in global business services?
It ranges from everything from administrative support to warehouse workers. And pretty much it's a very wide gamut, but unlike GSA OASIS, which has been recently awarded for the small business, at least their suite came out, that was aimed at professional services.
Mm-hmm.
The GBS is really strictly looking at the blue collar, the Service Contract Act type work. But you can get really everything from admin support up to warehouse workers, forklift drivers, and but it's a very wide range of Service Contract Act type work, and I really do think that'll be exciting when we can make that available for all DoD.
And since you mentioned OASIS, let me just ask, are you guys considering the use of OASIS for those professional services, or are you moving in that direction?
I'm very excited about OASIS, and it does present a great opportunity, again, for reducing redundancy, transactional duplication, and we're talking to some of the offices already about that, and we've identified a couple contract opportunities that maybe, you know, we'll be looking at when they come up for renewal, that OASIS may be a very viable alternative for, rather than going out with a full and open competition. And of course, since the OASIS small business came out first, it really makes us, again, be a little more circumspect, looking at the opportunities to convert some of our procurements that may have not gone small business before, but maybe we have an opportunity now to try to take advantage of that that community and expand. You know, we're all trying to meet goals with regard to the socioeconomic programs by creating vehicles that make it easier for contracting offices to meet those goals. So it's a win-win for everybody, the robust competition that usually comes about through these MAC vehicles may achieve savings as well as small business goals. So we'll see where that goes.
So fair to say on OASIS, still in kind of an exploratory phase rather than the sort of big pivot in that direction that the Air Force just made?
The Air Force made a major commitment to go towards OASIS. But unlike the Navy, we also have the Seaport MAC contracts,
right,
that are managed out of NAVC, and Air Force wasn't in that position. So we do have a little bit of a dialectic going on, because we do have other contracts already available that have been used by some commands, you know, with a lot of enthusiasm. But the OASIS presented them in a different way by providing this first suite that was directed really to small business. Within Seaport, we could go to the small business vendors. We could do set-asides and look for opportunities that way. But here, GSA's presented them in a completely different way. They're readily available, and they don't have to. We don't have to think about it too much. So that is exciting as well.
That's Jamie Hawk, the program manager for the Department of the Navy's Strategic Sourcing Program. He talked with us by phone from the Naval Supply Systems Command's offices in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. We'll post more information about the Navy's new contracts for conference planning services at federalnewsradio.com. Another short break, and when we come back, a focus on the financial management workforce within DoD. The latest annual survey of that workforce is out, and no surprise, morale is a serious issue. This is on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. And we'll turn our attention now to the DoD financial management workforce. Every year for the past 12 years, the American Society of Military Comptrollers and Grant Thornton have been surveying that workforce to identify trends and challenges. This year, overwhelmingly, respondents said the biggest issue in the military FM community is the workforce itself and its morale. Tracy Green of Grant Thornton is the survey's director. Last year's edition showed a significant drop in job satisfaction, particularly among senior executives in military financial management. She tells me that trend continued this year.
The preponderance of the respondents actually felt like morale was much worse. The senior levels were very much concerned about the workforce itself. And what's driving that morale down was the furloughs. People really have lost the trust in their employer. What they're saying is, my job isn't valued. I'm going to work my 8-hour days and I'm going home. There's no more extra commitment, because they just, that trust relationship between their employer and the employee has been broken.
Along those lines, one of the things that you found is that the respondents are saying that the challenges they're facing in the military financial management community are greater than they ever have before. In what ways did they tell you that that was happening?
They have less resources that they've to share the workload across than they've had in the past. They've also have a lot more focus and activities around getting ready for the audit. And then the other thing that's driving that increased workload is the very same people that are dealing with all the audit readiness activities are the very same ones that are having to do all the budgetary drills around the sequestrations and the what-if scenarios.
This whole idea of having to budget around continuing resolutions has been going on for a few years now. But I think one of the new things in this past year was that the Defense Department, anyway, basically had to build two budgets. Did people talk about that specifically and the added workload that that created?
They did. They talked about the not necessarily two budgets, but building the multiple budgets of, well, if this budget line got cut more than that budget line, or if we ended up in a sequestration again, or if we ended up with this type of budget reductions. And those very same people that are running all those budget drills are the same people that are trying to meet the 2014 and 2017 deadlines for the audits. In addition to doing their, what I'll call their day-to-day jobs of keeping the money flowing to the warfighter and getting what they need to actually execute the mission.
And we should be clear that that sort of dual role that people are working on very high op tempos with, it's in terms of audit and building multiple budgets, that's not coming along with a lot of staff augmentation to do those two things, right?
Not for the budgets, that's for sure. They do use a lot of contractor support when it comes to the audit readiness activities. And they use that because the staff internal to the department itself doesn't have those skills yet. So they're relying on experts from public accounting firms that they're bringing in as consultants and advisors to them to help them with their audit readiness. But when it comes to getting the data from the systems, finding those source documents, and documenting those processes, it's really taking on the government personnel have to take on that role because they know it. They're the only ones that can get into the systems. They're the only ones that really understand the process. They can tell the information to the contractors, but they have to be involved in it.
Okay.
And there's just been an uptick in the audit readiness activities, really.
Yeah, so let's stick on audit readiness. What did your respondents say had changed over the past year or so? I mean, has that operational tempo in that direction increased in ways that you can point to in specific ways? I mean, obviously the 2014 deadline for a statement of budgetary resources audit is just around the corner. Has that fueled that?
Yes, that is what most of the respondents were saying was fueling the pressure, is how they called it, is they were really feeling the pressure on them even more so to get to themselves in a position to be able to undergo that SBA audit. So a lot of the activities around the assertion packages that they prepare and doing some preliminary examinations was really stepping up a lot more than it had been in the past.
And what do people see as the current day challenges toward those audit readiness targets?
Getting the documentation in line for the auditors to be able to really see the information. It's the audit-ready documentation that they're all concerned about the most.
And how
improving that they've got the information.
And how about IT systems? We've heard so much about the importance of getting enterprise resource planning systems up and running toward making this a long-term sustainable effort. How do people feel like that's going?
They didn't really mention much through the survey process about the IT systems and the SSA 16, although that is part of the audit readiness activities that they're doing. You've seen DFAS focus a lot more resources over the past year in trying to get these DOD level systems to kind of support all the services to actually have that SSAE 16 in place. So there's been a lot of increase in that activity as well. So why they didn't mention it, just knowing that that's going on behind the scenes has to be contributing to the audit readiness
mm-hmm.
workload.
One of the things I think you're trying to get across in the report is even if the audit community within the financial management community is focused on this like a laser, they're dependent on people who aren't necessarily that committed to it or focused on it or paying that much attention to it. Can you talk about that particular
right.
aspect?
Yeah, so a lot of the financial managers that we spoke to, what they
what they were saying was, we rely on our program offices, our field level entities, our mission deliverers to actually be the ones that are the initiating point of all of the accounting transactions. It doesn't happen inside the organization. It happens in the field when there's a need determined to get more boots to the warfighter or whatever the case may be, right? Those those people out in those organizations don't understand the audit. They don't even really understand how what they're doing in the delivery of the mission is having a direct impact on what's going on in the accounting transactions that is being audited. And so there's been a learning curve that they've had to go through, at least under the organizations that have actually gone under audit. Once they go under audit, those non-financial management organizations kind of have this light bulb go off that says, I had no idea that this is actually what I did impacted what was going on in the financial management community. So there's been that level of awareness raised about, oh, I didn't know that I did that. So when the financial management community is trying to get the data, they actually have to go out to those people, get the information from them, and that's not those individuals' primary concern. So it becomes a secondary function that they have to kind of respond to the financial management community, and it just takes a back seat. So there's been that they mentioned. The other thing that they mentioned through the survey was that the non-financial management leadership really aren't behind this all the way either. They get the sense that they talk the game, and those are some of the quotes that we kind of heard. They talk the talk, but when it comes to actually walking the walk, you can see that financial management and audit readiness isn't in the forefront of their thoughts.
And did you get a sense from your respondents as to why that might be? I mean, I would just surmise, I guess, that everybody's in a period of dwindling resources here. And if your primary mission isn't financial management, something's going to take a back seat.
No, they really didn't provide any insights into that. If I were to speculate, I would say that the reason that support is not there for the financial management community in this effort is there's a lack of understanding as to how this data and the results of these audits can actually get them more resources to do things with.
We're talking with Tracy Green of Grant Thornton about their annual survey of the military financial management workforce, the latest edition, which they conduct every year in cooperation with the American Society of Military Comptrollers, is just out. We'll talk more after another quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. We'll wrap up the show with one more segment on the military financial management workforce. We're talking with Tracy Green from Grant Thornton. She's the survey director for the American Society of Military Comptrollers annual survey of the financial management community within DoD and the Coast Guard. The very opening of the report this year talks about the community realizing the need that if it's going to get the job done, it needs to rely more on some tools that maybe haven't been employed as much in the past. Talk about what you see as some of those key tools going forward.
They definitely need to get their ERP systems in place, or at least accounting systems that are better equipped to handle the document retention requirements that would put them in a position to be successful in the audit. The other tools that they definitely mentioned they needed were more information around analytics. They feel like they need to have good data to run scenarios with and do analytics on to actually streamline and make better decisions. So they definitely mentioned those two things. Cost accounting was mentioned a few times. Again, useful information around performing analytics and really understanding what it's costing them to do their business. Those, I think, are the theme of what we continually heard.
Sure. Another one you brought up is shared services. And there seemed to be a lack of appreciation for at least what shared services could potentially do across the department. Talk about what you found there.
Well, everyone immediately recognized that they already have in the department a lot of shared service providers. One of the ones they consistently mentioned was DFAS. And the report actually gives recognition to the fact that DFAS is a service provider, but it's a very unique service provider in the standpoint of they actually perform a role beyond what a traditional service provider does, because DFAS uses the accounting systems that are owned or used to be owned by the Army, Navy, and Air Force in order to perform their functions. So they run a different accounting system for Navy transactions and a different accounting system for Army transactions and so forth. And a traditional service provider wouldn't do that. A traditional service provider would provide a system and you use that system, and that's what they're there for. That's why they have the tag as a service provider. That's what they're known for. So DFAS, while they all view it as a service provider, really is a different spin on the service provider for them. The other thing that they mentioned was they'll never let their resources or their financial management, they didn't think, be conducted outside of the DoD environment just because of the sensitivity of the transactions that they process. They wouldn't rely on anybody else or want to rely on anybody else to do that. So they're okay with service providers inside their own domain, but they don't want it to go outside the DoD domain. Very resistance across the board, we heard.
Interesting.
For that.
Let me go back to where we started, which is workforce. One of the big pushes from the DoD Comptroller's office has been to get this financial management certification program up and running. How far down the road are they, and how are people taking it so far?
So they're just initially getting that program started, and a lot of people are very optimistic that it's going to help them. They believe it's going to provide the right training. What they're concerned about is if they don't get to apply that training right away, they're going to lose the skill. So how valuable will it actually be to getting them more knowledge about the financial management environment? They feel like it's set up for the right thing, but the actual execution and implementation of the skills they learn might be delayed and might cause them some challenges.
And I think you found the folks in the trenches were generally, as you said, supportive of this, and people in the leadership positions were a bit more skeptical of it. What do you think's behind that?
I think what's behind it is the folks at the leadership level actually see some of the delays in the implementation of the skills that they learn, and that's where that concern about how effective is it really going to be in actuality is coming in at.
Let's cover contractor support just a little bit more. You mentioned it, but I think what you're getting at in the report is that the roles that contractors play in the department right now are pretty different from organization to organization, and there's some, I guess I'll say, optimization that could happen there. Is that about right?
Yeah. A lot of the organizations are using the IPAs, the public accounting firms, to support them in their audit readiness. We didn't hear a lot about use of the contractors in actual, what I'll call, government-centric functions, right? Inherently governmental. It's more, their focus is more on, they're the expertise. They understand what is going to take to get us to audit, and so we're bringing them in to help us do this, and eventually we know we have to supplement those resources with our own, but they felt like they weren't anywhere close to being able to supplement that contractor support at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's important to recognize across the board, Jared, is, you know, consistently we heard the top three concerns from everybody. Everyone is really concerned about the people at the leadership level, because we polled the executives specifically with this question. We didn't do this as part of the online survey, but all of the executives are very concerned about the morale and the retention of the workforce, and even being able to attract new people to the environment, given what's gone on with furloughs and shutdowns over the past year. The other thing they were worried about was the budget constraints and the stability that those constraints are actually providing to them to be able to execute the mission of the organization. And then their third was very consistently the modernization of the information technology system.
Yeah, I think those are themes that we always hear out of these issues. I mean, you've been doing this for 12 years now, Grant Thornton has anyway, and the Military Comptrollers Society. Yes. Has that workforce issue always been up front?
I think it's more up front this year than it ever has been in the past, just in to a T, that was always the first thing out of everybody's mouth. We heard it a little bit last year, but almost consistently it was the first thing everybody said. We're really just concerned about our workforce, not just the workload, but actually, are we going to be able to keep them because we've really done some damage to that trust between us and them?
That's Tracy Green of Grant Thornton talking with me about their annual survey of the military financial management workforce, the latest edition, which they conduct every year in cooperation with the American Society of Military Comptrollers, is just out. We'll post a link to it at federalnewsradio.com. And that does it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back with another edition next week at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.